All right. Well, thanks very much for coming out. We're kind of in the process of wrapping up our study that we did on Lex Rex. And what I'm trying to do here is, in the light of the Lex Rex that we completed, to have a look at other Reformed thinkers or thinking and to see if there's agreement or disagreement or overlap or whatever. So in Rutherford's book, which I don't intend to summarize, God's law was the law of the nation, and when a ruler acted contrary to that law, he didn't retain his authority as a ruler in that matter or on that matter. And so we're going to begin our look at this kind of idea in the writings of John Calvin, fundamentally in his Institutes, but one or two other places. Calvin's Institutes was first published in 1536, so Rutherford's book came out in 1644, so Calvin is a long time before him. And Calvin's book, when he published it in 1536, there was a letter at the beginning of the book that served as an introduction to the book, and that letter was written to the King of France, and it was addressing the persecution that was taking place in France, the Protestants being persecuted for their faith. And Calvin addressed the king and kind of dedicated his book to the king in that sense. And the letter contained instruction and rebuke. Guys I've read on Calvin said that they felt he was too confrontational with the king in his letter. In the Institutes, Calvin was anxious to emphasize the fact that the Protestants were not opposed to civil authority and that the scriptures called upon believers to obey and submit to civil rulers. He emphasized that very strongly. The historical context is important because on the one hand there were accusations flying around that the Protestants were seditious and were bent on undermining civil authority. So that's on the one hand the real enemies of the Protestants. That was the message that was going around. And on the other hand you had people that would call themselves Protestants, like the Anabaptists, that had the view that now that you're in Christ you need no civil authority, because you have full liberty and freedom. Or another twist on that was that unless the civil authority was 100% in accordance with the Mosaic law, they had no authority. So Calvin has those two things that he's battling with on the ground: the rebellion of the Protestants or the Anabaptists' positions. So he was speaking to very real situations, very real things were happening. The last thing that Calvin dealt with in the Institutes was civil government. So his book is divided into four books. And book four, chapter 20, is the last book of the whole of the Institutes, and he deals in that chapter with civil governments. For our purposes, we need to establish what Calvin understood about law with respect to the civil realm. And that just helps us understand, well, where is he coming from? What does he think about law? When he says law, what does he mean? So he said the moral law, to begin first with it, is contained under two heads, one of which simply commands us to worship God with pure faith and piety, the other to embrace men with sincere affection. Accordingly, it is the true and eternal rule of righteousness prescribed for men of all nations and times who wish to conform their lives to God's will. For it is the eternal and unchangeable will that He Himself indeed be worshipped by us all, and that we love one another. So he says that's the purpose of the moral law. He says the ceremonial law was the tutelage of the Jews with which it seemed good to the Lord to train his people as it were in their childhood until the fullness of the times should come, in order that he might fully manifest his wisdom to the nations and show the truth of these things which were foreshadowed in figures. So you got the moral law, which summarizes the whole of what he expects, the ceremonial law. And then Calvin talked about the judicial law, given to them for civil government, imparted certain formulas of equity and justice by which they might live together blamelessly and peaceably. Those ceremonial practices indeed properly belonged to the doctrine of piety, inasmuch as they kept the church of the Jews in service and reverence of God, and yet could be distinguished from piety itself. You see the essence of piety. He's trying to see that he could give you the ceremonial law and say it's not completely separated from piety. It included piety, but there's a point where you could separate them without destroying piety. Okay, it's important that you see that. That's what he's trying to reason with the laws. In like manner, the form of their judicial laws, although it had no other intent than how best to preserve the very love which is enjoined by God's eternal law, had something distinct from that precept of love. Okay, what was the purpose of the judicial laws of how to run the nation? Was to preserve love. What is love? Love is how you relate to and treat one another in your day-to-day activities. He says it was definitely, that's the reason for it, but there was also something part of it in the words that were used that is distinct from that. And you can put that aside without destroying love. Therefore, as ceremonial laws could be abrogated while piety remained safe and unharmed, so too, when these judicial laws were taken away, the perpetual duties and precepts of love could still remain. But if this is true, surely every nation is left free to make such laws as it foresees to be profitable for itself. Yet these must be in conformity to the perpetual rule of love, so that they indeed vary in form, but have the same purpose. For I do not think that those barbarous and savage laws, such as gave honor to thieves, permitted promiscuous intercourse, and others, both more filthy and more absurd, are to be regarded as laws. For they are abhorrent, and not only to all justice, but also to all humanity and gentleness. Okay, so that's section 15 of chapter 20 of his institute. So he's trying to lay out what law means and how he's going to define it. In the next section, I'm going to do quite a bit of reading to start off with, just because I think this is important, this section of establishing what he's thinking here. He says in section 16, "What I have said will become plain if in all laws we examine, as we should, these two things: the constitution of the law and the equity on which its constitution is itself founded and rests. Equity, because it is natural, cannot but be the same for all, and therefore the same purpose ought to apply to all laws, whatever their object." Calvin means all the laws in the whole world for everybody. There's the constitution of the law, the makeup of the law, the construction of the law. And then there's the equity, that's the reason we worded this law, that's the reason we created this law, is because of this eternal equity that is binding upon all people for all time. Constitutions have certain circumstances upon which they in part depend. It therefore does not matter that they are different, provided all equally press toward the same goal of equity. Okay, so you've got, he's saying, he's talking in the context of the judicial laws that are gone, the equity is there. He's saying, and different nations can have different constitutions, they can have different laws, as long as the equity is the same. So, for example, I'll give you the common one we usually use. The railing around the roof of the house is the actual wording in the Bible. But what was the equity of that? The equity of that was the preservation of life, because they entertain guests on the roof. We don't want people to fall off the roof, so we put a railing there. The equity is to make your laws to preserve life. So you could make a law, as some cities do, that you've got to have a swimming pool fenced in so that some stranger or neighbor doesn't fall into your swimming pool. That's changing the law in a sense, but it's the same law. It's the same equity law. So you're not removing anything from the equity that God expects for all people. It is a fact that the law of God, which we call the moral law, is nothing else than a testimony of natural law and of the conscience which God has engraved upon the minds of men. Consequently, the entire scheme of this equity of which we are now speaking has been prescribed in it. Hence, this equity alone must be the goal and rule and limit of all laws. Natural law, which is obvious to everybody, is the standard. But it's checked, and the definitive explanation of natural law are the scriptures. Whatever laws shall be framed to that rule, directed to that goal, bound to that limit, there is no reason why we should disapprove of them, howsoever they may differ from the Jewish law or amongst themselves. God's law is universally binding and it is the only righteous standard for every realm. These are my words. It's the only standard for every realm of authority and responsibility. Calvin ends the Institutes by repeating this idea in very strong terms and applying it to the dusty details of conflict that arise in the realm of rulers and the ruled. What he says in this section appears very clear. So he's just established the fact that the only standard for truth and righteousness is the law of God, which is pictured in natural law. And then he keeps going. That was in section 16 of chapter 20. And then you get to the last section of chapter 20, which is section 32. He says, "But in that obedience that we have shown to be due the authority of rulers, we are always to make this exception, indeed to observe it as primary, that such obedience is never to lead us away from obedience to him, to whose will the desires of all kings ought to be subject, to whose decrees all their commands ought to yield, to whose majesty their scepters ought to be submitted." And how absurd would it be that in satisfying men you should incur the displeasure of him for whose sake you obey men themselves? The Lord therefore is the King of kings, who when he has opened his sacred mouth must alone be heard before all and above all men. Next to him we are subject to those men who are in authority over us, but only in him. If they command anything against him, let it go unesteemed. And here let us not be encouraged about all the dignity which the magistrate possesses, for no harm is done to it when it is humbled before the singular and truly supreme power of God. On this consideration, and this was an addition from what I just read there in this last section, that was in the 1536 version which came out. In 1559 Calvin made his last revision of that work, and then he inserted this paragraph that I'm going to read now. "On this consideration, Daniel denies that he had committed any offense against the king when he has not obeyed an impious edict in Daniel 6:22. For the king had exceeded his limits and had not only been a wronger, had been a wrongdoer against him, but in lifting up his horns against God had himself abrogated his power. Conversely, the Israelites are condemned because they were too obedient to the wicked proclamation of the king in Isaiah 5:13. For when Jeroboam molded the golden calves, they to please him forsook God's temple and turned to new superstitions in 1 Kings 12:30. With the same readiness, their descendants compiled the decrees of their kings. The prophet sharply reproaches them for embracing the king's edicts, Hosea 5:11. Far indeed is the pretense of modesty from deserving praise, a false modesty which the court flatterers cloak themselves and deceive the simple, while they deny that it is lawful for them to refuse anything imposed by their king, as if God had made over his right to mortal men, giving them the rule over mankind, or as if earthly power were diminished when it is subjected to its author, in whose presence even the heavenly powers tremble as suppliants." And finally he ends off with a paragraph that's in the 1536 edition and continues unchanged throughout the rest of the editions. "I know with what great and present peril this constancy is menaced, because kings bear defiance with the greatest displeasure, whose wrath is a messenger of death," says Solomon. "But since this edict has been proclaimed by the heavenly herald Peter, we must obey God rather than men, Acts 5:29. Let us comfort ourselves with the thought that we are rendering that obedience which the Lord requires when we suffer anything rather than turn aside from piety, and that our courage may not grow faint. Paul pricks us with another goad, that we have been redeemed by Christ at so great a price as our redemption cost him, so that we should not enslave ourselves to the wicked desires of men, much less be subject to their impiety," in 1 Corinthians 7:23. Okay, when you read section 32 of Calvin, to me that's pure Rutherford. I don't see any difference between Calvin and Rutherford at that point. The problem, though, is that in the same chapter in the Institutes, Calvin wrote some things that appear to say that individuals are not allowed to ever resist those in authority over them. The only command that is given to individuals in the state, this is a quote, is to obey and suffer. That's found in section 31 of chapter 20. Calvin said, lesser magistrates had the responsibility to challenge the king and overthrow a tyrant. This was their duty in that same section of section 31. But Calvin wrote in section 23 of that, the magistrate cannot be resisted without God being resisted at the same time. Moreover, under this obedience I include the restraint which private citizens ought to bid themselves keep in public, that they may not deliberately intrude in public affairs, or pointlessly invade the magistrate's office, or undertake anything at all politically. If anything in the public ordinance requires amendment, let them not raise a tumult, or put their hands to the task. All of them ought to keep their hands bound in this respect, but let them commit the matter to the judgment of the magistrate, whose hand alone here is free. Section 23. It will come clearer as we move on, but I think it seems clear that that section, he's dealing with individuals making political changes to the structures and the laws by uprising, riotous uprising. They're going to make these changes. And so that's what he's dealing with. I don't want you invading offices. I don't want you. We've seen that in our own country of recent months. Hoodlums doing that kind of stuff. Saying we don't want any of that. In the next section, section 24, Calvin says that he had up until then been describing good kings. But what about evil kings? He says, consequently, many cannot be persuaded that they ought to recognize these as princes and to obey their authority as far as possible. That's the Battle's translation. In the Beveridge translation we read, many cannot be persuaded to recognize such persons for princes whose command, as far as lawful, they are bound to obey. Okay, so Battle says as far as possible they are to obey it. Beveridge even brings that out to try and bring out the sense it's as far as is lawfully possible. Those are the commands, as far as obeying those. What Calvin then sets out to try and do is prove that wicked kings, while they still remain in the office of king, actually retain the authority of that office. That's what he's now going to go on from section 24 right through section 29. He's going to try and prove that they actually have the authority of that office. Okay, but bearing in mind section 32, he's already said what is lawful authority and what is not. But now he's debating the point, and I think this is where people misunderstand that, and they see it as absolute statements against doing any resistance. In the next section, Calvin says, they who rule unjustly and incompetently have been raised up by God to punish the wickedness of the people. But let us rather pause here to prove this, which does not so easily settle in men's minds. In a very wicked man, utterly unworthy of all honor, provided he has the public power in his hands, that noble and divine power resides which the Lord has by his word given to the minister of his justice and judgment. So God has made an office, he has given authority to that office, and while this person is in that office, he retains the power that's associated with the office. But it's justice that is still the key here. Accordingly, he should be held in the same reverence and esteem, the same reverence and esteem by his subject, insofar as public obedience is concerned, in which they would hold the best of kings if he were given to them. I suggest to you that Calvin is standing against rioting and chaos. I say this because of what we have read in the last section of this chapter already, in section 32. So what is he doing? He either introduced something completely contradictory in section 32 to what he had said previously, or we can see his flow of argument. He's trying to deal with people who say, this king is a tyrant, he is no longer a king. And so the individual says, we have absolutely no reason to obey him in anything. And he's saying, no, we don't go there. That is wrong. We can't do that. So every time we think that a statement that we're reading in these sections here, before section 32, is saying no resistance is allowed, we need to read it in the light of section 32 as well as in the light of this thrust that I believe he's on now, trying to prove who a king is, and that even a tyrant retains, while he's in that position, retains legitimate authority. Calvin, in the next section, still proving that tyrants hold the authority of the office ordained by God, writes again, Daniel says to Nebuchadnezzar's son Belshazzar, "The Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar your father kingship and magnificence, honor and glory." Daniel 5:18. Okay, so he's saying, where did your father get his authority? God gave it to him. It's from God. And he was placed in that position. So Calvin is using that to conclude this. He quotes that verse to conclude this. "When we hear that a king has been ordained by God, let us at once call to mind these heavenly edicts with regard to honoring and fearing a king. Then we shall not hesitate to hold a most wicked tyrant in the place where the Lord has deigned to set him." That's section 26. The problem with that, the title in Battle's translation of Calvin's Institutes, the title above section 26 is supplied by the editor. It's not supplied by Calvin. And the title says, "Obedience to Bad Kings Required in Scripture." And it kind of says, oh, this is the principle. Now we're going to learn about what is required in the face of bad kings. So as you go into that section, you've already got the headline. And now you're going to see, oh, he's proving that this is Calvin's position. You've got to obey bad kings. Calvin continued in that section with the example of Samuel's description of what a king would do when the people asked for a king. Calvin wrote, "Surely the king would not do this by legal right, since the Lord trained them to all restraint," Deuteronomy 17:16. So that what the things that Samuel described the king they were asking for would do, he says he's not doing it by legal right, because that's it, what he's doing is illegal. "But it was called a right in relation to the people, to these rebellious people, for they had to obey it and were not allowed to resist it. It is as if Samuel had said, 'The willfulness of kings will run to excess, but it will not be your part to restrain it. You will have only this left to you, to obey their commands and hearken to their words.'" Calvin's not fickle. He's not confused. He had a tremendous memory. And he's just revised this book over and over with developing circumstances in life that would have jogged him and made him wrestle through and think through these issues. He's not confused about what he had written. And he certainly wasn't contradicting himself within a single chapter. The section is not laying down the responsibility of subjects towards tyrants, but showing that a tyrant retains his authority while he remains in his office, and that God does use tyrants to punish rebellious. Section 32 qualifies. What is the responsibility of the righteous? What is their and their qualifications as well? So that qualifies us. What are my responsibilities, as well as his other qualifications, even through the section that says as far as possible. You must obey as far as possible. Now, what do you think? How far is as far as possible? We'd have to come back to section 32. We'd have to go to the chapters, sections 15 and 16, where he's talking about law and natural law and what binds kings and what doesn't bind kings. Calvin says, "But you will say rulers owe responsibilities in turn to their subjects. This I have already admitted. But if you conclude from this that service ought to be rendered only to just governors, you are reasoning foolishly." Calvin says that in all areas of authority, those under the authority, they are still subject even to those who are wicked and undutiful. Section 29. Okay, so you're subject, even though they are. So what is he saying you're subject to? He's saying you're subject to their office. But he's not saying, because 32 clearly shows us, he's not saying you're subject to everything that comes out of their mouth. He's saying the office retains its authority. It retains all that it had and has. And we mustn't just write off the office because of the wickedness that's coming out of it. And so he lays that out, and he's, in my understanding of what Calvin is saying here, he's hammering that very strongly, that you've got to realize he's still the king. And then in the next two sections, section 30 and 31, he then goes into, how do you actually remove this king? He said, you go with the lesser magistrates. You remove him with the lesser magistrates. They have been given the charge with respect to changing laws or kings. And then after all the emphasis upon obeying the civil authorities, he goes into section 32, which we've read, which Calvin himself titled, "Obedience to man must not become disobedience to God." He begins that section, as we've seen, with, "But in that obedience which we have shown to be due the authority of rulers, we are always to make this exception. Indeed, to observe it as primary, that such obedience is never to lead us away from obedience to Him, to whose will the desires of all kings ought to be subject, to whose decrees all their commands ought to yield, to whose majesty their scepters ought to be submitted. And how absurd would it be that in satisfying men you should incur the displeasure of Him for whose sake you obey men themselves? Why do you obey men? Because God said. So now you're going to obey this man and contrary to God? No, the reason we obey men is in order to honor God. And I do not honor God when I obey Him when He's acting contrary to God. That's how I understand Calvin's reasoning here. Calvin spoke much of the royal dignity of the office that people had to honor. He said, remember, all those 24, I think it's 24 through 29, he's trying to prove the point that they retained this dignity, this office. There's something dignified about the office, and they retained that. And so he's emphasized that. And yet now he says, if they command, this is in section 32, if they command anything against God, let it go unesteemed. And here, let us not be concerned about all that dignity which the magistrate possesses, for no harm is done to that dignity, to that office, when it is humbled before the singular and only and truly supreme power of God. The French, there's another edition of the Institutes that Calvin wrote his Institutes in Latin. He was writing for the scholars and then he also translated his own, particularly in the 1541 edition that he wrote. He translated that himself into French for the people in France so that they could understand it. And so this same thing in the French one has, and we should have no regard for the whole dignity of their rule, which we do not harm at all when we put it under God's power, which is the only true power by comparison with others. So we're not offending the dignity of the office when we put that under the power of God. So, as I said, in the final revision of his Institutes, there was that paragraph that he inserted. I'm just going to take the first sentence from that. So he inserted that in the final edition, 1559. On this consideration, Daniel denies that he had committed any offense against the king when he had not obeyed his impious edict, Daniel 6:22. For the king had exceeded his limits and had not only been a wrongdoer against men, but in lifting up his horns against God, had himself abrogated his power. So that's his take on Daniel 6:2. Now Calvin's take on Daniel 6:2. Calvin finished his latest revision of the Institutes, as I said, in May 1559. He began lecturing on Daniel in June 1559, and he completed Daniel in April of 1560, and then that was printed in 61. Daniel, in his commentary, when he came to this verse that we've just talked about in the Institutes, that he's spoken about there, he says in his commentary on Daniel, Daniel therefore rightly defends himself here by saying that he had committed no fault against the king. Precisely because he was compelled to obey the rule of God, he disregarded what the king had commanded to the contrary. For earthly princes abdicate their power when they rise up against God. Worse, they are unworthy to be accounted in the number of men. We ought rather to spit in their faces than obey them when they are so shameless as to want to even to despoil God of his right and, as it were, occupy his throne, as if they could drag him out of heaven. That's the end of the quote. That's from the Parker translation of Daniel 6:22. These words were written about 5 months after he had finished revising the Institutes, teaching on the civil magistrate. Now, Calvin's mind and memory were both phenomenal. And so we should not rush to accuse him of contradiction or inconsistency. And many do that when they're reading Calvin. They're saying, well, he contradicted himself in these passages and he's inconsistent. I'm not prepared to do that. And I think how I've tried to handle Calvin is when you get to like section 32 and you realize, whoa, and then you go back to the sections that you think, I think he's actually removing the right to resist in these. You go back and you read them carefully and you say, no, he's not. He's not doing that. He's actually trying to lay out his defense of his position here while fully upholding section 32. And then when he, after his final revision, he goes into Daniel and speaks very strongly. Either he's woefully contradicting himself or we're misunderstanding his thrust of what he's trying to lay out and prove. So I suggest to you that the foundation that Rutherford was standing upon, and next time what I want to do, and certainly next time we're going to wrap it up, but next time I want to look at a few other maybe key Reformed thinkers on this and just see if they're saying the same thing, and then try and together with that wrap up our view of where obedience, submission, and what those would look like in our circumstances.